The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. All right, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 5 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. The title of this podcast is Fixing Fight Club, 21st Century Nuclear Renaissance. So a little bit of housekeeping, as usual. I wanted to call your attention to the Sean Ryan Show, episode 149, with Sarah Adams, who apparently was a CIA analyst of one sort or another. She's been on his show before. I really like her presentation. I think she may be underestimating the total size of the threat of what's going to happen when an upsize or supersize invasion and violent calamity strikes the United States, when jihadists have simultaneous days of mayhem that will harken back to what happened in Israel as a result of the Gaza incursion in October of 2023. So with that, I would refer you once again to my companion podcast, the original podcast, which is Chasing Ghost, an Irregular Warfare podcast, to which War Notes is an adjunct, and episodes 37, 41 through 43, 49 through 50. Those are 5 episodes of my Storming America podcast series, in which I conducted a thought experiment and a thoroughly detailed examination of what this calamity would look like if they did supersize the events that happened from Gaza to Israel in the United States as we speak. So I would call your attention to that. I also call your attention to that Sean Ryan Show podcast episode, but also Sean Ryan does a great podcast series, so I would urge all of you to give it a listen if you get a chance. As always, I am so grateful to my listenership and my readership at my Substack. You will find in the show notes the all the addresses that you need to get in touch with me. And one address is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I love to hear constructive criticism, questions, recommendations that my listenership may have, and maybe even my readership on occasion, on my Substack page, where I have a comment section attached to every episode. And I always look forward to hearing from you about what your concerns, recommendations, questions, and elucidations are about the topics we cover here. This Fight Club series that I am currently doing on War Notes is all about me doing a weekly issuance instead of my usual fortnightly cadence in putting podcast episodes out, because I'm in a run to complete almost a, well, what will inevitably be an incomplete, but as complete as I can make it before the end of January, assessment of how we can take the U.S. Department of Defense and the coalitions and allies that are joining hands with America in conducting military operations planet-wide, conducting military operations technically and professionally speaking, and how to improve what is obviously a failed enterprise. A failed enterprise and one of the most expensive paper tigers in the history of the world in the realm of warfare and conflict would be the United States military since 1945, which has a sterling track record of zero success and victories and an unblemished record of defeat and stalemate since 1945. You will also find a number of books and maybe locations on the net where I conducted research for this particular episode, to include the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, which I have been following arguably since the 1980s. They do have a political axe to grind, but nonetheless, they probably provide, within the unclassified realm, and of course that's all we talk about here is the unclassified realm. We do speculate on occasion, but that's all it is speculation. Probably the very best technical analysis of nuclear weapons, nuclear inventories, nuclear production, and everything associated with that vast scientific complex in America and the West that's available to the general public. I would urge you to check it out. It will be in the show notes if you take a look. Now, America for the longest time has relied on what it has characterized as a nuclear triad. And that nuclear triad would be SLBM, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, missile silos, conventional, everything from the early manifestations of the Titans to the Minuteman 1, 2, and 3, and that Minuteman 3 is currently what is used in the U.S. inventory for those land-based silo systems that we have in the continental United States. And then, of course, the bomber forces with their Whiskey Gulf bombs that they have in various instantiations that are used on those manned bomber bombing missions. So that comprises the triad. The triad was designed originally so that it would be a fail-safe function in which if one of those legs of this nuclear triad, pick one as you wish, were to be neutralized or destroyed by another nuclear power or non-nuclear power, and we're going to talk about that later, in the world, that those other two legs would be there as either backups or complements to sending nuclear weapons aloft and making them land in the correct place. So that's where we're at now, but what we do find is this, is that if you look at the history of nuclear weapons from 1945 to present, what we have is we have a peak from 86 to 88, just before the wall fell, of approximately 60,000 nuclear weapons worldwide. Now, we fast forward to our time period that we have now, and there are less than 10,000 nuclear warheads around the world. Those nuclear warheads are possessed, for the most part, by the U.S., Russia, and China, and then in much smaller numbers by the U.K., France, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. Now, what you also see is that there have been, on occasion, countries that have successfully sidelined, neutralized, or eliminated their nuclear inventories. I would call your attention to South Africa, which in a joint program from the 60s through the 70s with the Israelis, developed their own atomic munitions and even had what is allegedly their first atomic test, open air that is, probably an airburst, not a ground burst, as was so common in the United States for so many of its nuclear weapons testing. Well, this would also include Russia, in 1977 over the Atlantic Ocean. Since that time, the South African nuclear inventory has been reduced to zero, and then you have Belarusia, and you have the Ukraine, and of course, what happened in agreements with the USSR, which would turn into Russia later on, is that they would, Russia proper, would repatriate all those nuclear warheads and their delivery vehicles back to Russia proper post-1991. Russia has a huge nuclear inventory. China has one that's starting to get bigger and bigger. The U.S., of course, has decommissioned a wide number of them, but I would call your attention to the fact that, as I've mentioned before, when it comes to intelligence, when it comes to compartmentalization, when it comes to secrecy regimes and things like that, we can't always put our finger on the pulse of what has been and what is now. Here's some things that we do know. I just mentioned the triad and the way that's used for the U.S. inventory for the projection of nuclear weapons. These weapons of mass destruction in the nuclear irradiation realm were employed in a way that was sort of a tacit agreement during the Cold War that mutually assured destruction, appropriately named MAD, would be the instance where between Russia and the United States, each had so many nuclear weapons that if nuclear weapons were launched in a first-use policy, a second-use policy, a response policy, let's keep in mind that in the 1980s, because of the size of the Soviet Warsaw Pact forces in Eastern Europe, a first-use policy of nuclear weapons was developed and endorsed by the U.S. and NATO in case a conventional Soviet invasion started heading west to take on Western Europe. I've always considered mutually assured destruction, MAD, that I just mentioned, to be MAD not only philosophically, intellectually, and morally, but also it really lacks utility, especially if one has a social contract in a country where you're saying we're going to protect the population. But protection of the population, as I will mention later on when we start talking about a book called Raven Rock, is not something that the American government, for instance, has always taken in as a high priority. And what you discover is Ronald Reagan in the 1980s takes on what I consider to be a morally defensible position when it came to nuclear weapons by adopting the Strategic Defense Initiative, in which the country, the U.S. in particular, and the Russians had already been doing this kind of thing, would find a way not only to launch in the MAD doctrine where you are trading salvos, but they would find a way to intercept those very missiles that were incoming. Now, we have to be sober about all of this. The Strategic Defense Initiative, to include Brilliant Pebbles and other very technologically sophisticated programs in the 1980s, which if we were to take today's technology and start to dust off those enterprises, maybe even finding rocket engineers that just so happen to be in the West, and find ways to ameliorate the threat by intercepting the threat, that maybe we could find a way that instead of trading salvos, once said salvos are launched with a good probability of kill, you could intercept, neutralize, and destroy them before any of those nuclear munitions make landfall. In my mind, and I'm certain there are secret realms of the U.S. government that are devoted to finding out how to do this, there must be a fashion in which one, if you're talking about nuclear weapons that are launched at one another, it seems to me a moral obligation to find a way to neutralize said munitions when they're inbound. One way this is done, for instance, is there are currently, and these are very expensive, and I've talked about them in the past, there are ground-based mid-course interceptors in the U.S. inventory, mostly on the West Coast, that are designed to intercept incoming munitions. Now, I want you to keep something in mind here, and that's this. Since the 1950s, intercontinental ballistic missiles and intermediate-range ballistic missiles have been hypersonic, which means that they have speeds in excess on their terminal velocity coming from apogee, which means the highest point from which they are launched, in excess of Mach 5 to Mach 7. Very fast movers coming in and inbound. And what you discover when it comes to defending against hypersonic missiles and hypersonic munitions that are inbound, and there's going to be two subcases to that. You're going to have those missiles that are coming in at very high speeds that have no terminal maneuvering capability whatsoever. And then you'll have a second, much smaller set, but one that's going to emerge in a big way in the 21st century through fin mixing, terminally maneuvering munitions, which makes the interception of said munitions when they're coming in excess of speeds of Mach 5 and Mach 7, almost impossible for present technology to intercept. Now, I mentioned those mid-course ground interceptors. The U.S. inventory has, and this is all open source, 44 of these. 44. Remember, I mentioned there are less than 10,000 munitions worldwide that belong to all countries, most of which belong to the U.S. and Russia. Now, let's suppose there are incoming munitions. Let's posit fantastically that it just so happens that 11 munitions on rockets are launched by North Korea, and they're on their way, and they've reached apogee, and then they offload their bus. A bus, in this case, is the technical term for all those munitions that are parked at the top of the missile, that when it reaches its highest altitude, which is just below suborbital space in some cases, that then it launches those, they tip, and they start traveling back to Earth in a rather savage parabola. The way probability of kill works for intercepting air-breathing munitions that are coming in, and this could be a TACMS, this could be the SM series of missiles that the Navy employs, that probability of kill is how many missiles must I send aloft in order to intercept the incoming missile that is coming in? Well, number one, and most importantly, if those missiles have offloaded from the bus at apogee, remember, apogee is the highest peak from which it starts to tip and go back to Earth. If they're on their way in, these mid-course interceptors, billions of dollars worth, by the way, have no possibility of intercepting them. They're trying to intercept the bus just before it offloads. But Even then, that means that I have to send to have a probability of kill above 90%. I have to send four missiles against one to ensure neutralization at that percentage. It doesn't mean that, oh, I've spotted one, I've queued on incoming, I've established what the apogee point is, the highest altitude of release, I've done all the calculations, I've come up with a brilliant fire solution, and this is fired to make sure it meets there. It has to meet there at a very particular time. And that particular time is this instance where just before it tips and drops, you can intercept it then. Because once one or all of those munitions tip, come into the atmosphere, and start burning in, these mid-course ground interceptors have no possibility of a workable fire solution to neutralize or destroy those munitions. So these 44, again, billions of dollars, mid-course interceptors that America has don't do the job properly because they cannot intercept. No one can intercept, by the way, either terminally fin mixing or terminally ballistic incoming hypervelocity munitions. No one's there to do it. The technology hasn't been bested. Now, are hypersonic weapons available below the IRBM and ICBM thresholds of missile performance and such? Of course they are. We see some of these being employed around the world. What happens here is that there is no defensive modality against these. And to me, that is a critical shortcoming when it comes to the DOD, in this case, the U.S., the U.S. Department of Defense, where they have had literally decades to craft or possibly find some kind of amelioration mechanism that can intercept hypervelocity munitions that are inbound. No such thing exists planet-wide. Hence, the mad conceit that if you launch said nuclear weapons at America, in this case, or Europe, in another case, then what's going to happen is salvos of nuclear weapons from those three legs of the nuclear stool that I talked about at the beginning of this episode are going to be employed so that everybody destroys each other. It's a suicide pact, basically. A suicide pact that takes into account allegedly rational actors, but for all the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been spent over decades just not on the creation of weapon systems, not on any of this, but hiring corporations like the RAND Corporation, which is mostly government-funded, the nuclear weapons complexes around the world. There's been a lot of intellectual and academic heavy lifting going on behind the veil and cloaked in various regimes of secrecy that has played this prisoner's game, that has played this out and tried to find ways to war game it quite literally into this salvo competition and determine, well, what's going to happen if there are rational actors, there's not rational actors, what's going to happen if they're singletons like North Korea or Pakistan. Pakistan, by the way, has a very interesting notion when it comes to their nuclear weapons for some reason where their nuclear weapons are not attached to their delivery systems, in this case, their rocket delivery systems. And by the way, nuclear weapons are a very sophisticated modality that demands a very special and expensive competency level in putting these things together. And as Elon Musk has said about rocketry and rocket engineering to send things aloft into space to low Earth orbit is probably one of the most sophisticated and difficult engineering projects that human beings have ever undertaken in their scientific history. It is the combination of the efficacy and brilliance in designing nuclear munitions themselves, but also attached to that, if you don't have a proper delivery system that gives you a CEP, a circular error of probability at terminus after traveling thousands of miles to land where you think the targets are that you intend on destroying, then you don't really have a capability that's going to make the world quiver or nations that you target quiver. Now, in May of 2024, the U.S. Department of Defense maintained an estimated stockpile of approximately 3,708 nuclear warheads for delivery by ballistic missiles and aircraft. Most of the warheads in the stockpile are not deployed, but rather stored for potential upload onto missiles and aircraft as necessary. I want you to keep that little nugget in mind, because when we talk about 3,708 nuclear warheads, that does not mean that they are either on the wing routes, ready on submarine silos, on SSBNs that are traveling deep in the ocean, or in the land-based missile systems that we have with siloed Minuteman III's and such. I can't tell you what the number is that are actually on the tip of a missile about to be launched, or ready to be put on the wing route, or on the wing of B-52s or whatever bomber modality is being employed. Now, the Union of Atomic Scientists estimates that approximately 1,770 warheads are currently deployed, of which roughly 1,370 strategic warheads are deployed on ballistic missiles, and another 300 at strategic bomber bases in the United States. An additional 100 tactical bombs are deployed at air bases in Europe. The remaining warheads, approximately 1,938, are in storage as a so-called hedge against technical or geopolitical surprises. Several hundred of those warheads are scheduled to be retired before 2030. And what you discover here that's very interesting when you start digging into this is, remember, we had a peak in 1986 to 1988 of 60,000 warheads planet-wide, and now there are less than 10,000 planet-wide. I just gave you the numbers for the United States. I'm not going to bother you with the Russian inventory and the Chinese inventory. You can research that for yourselves. And whether they have most of those poised on delivery vehicles or not, but what estimate one can make is that roughly one-third minus of all publicly advertised warheads that America possesses are in a state in which they can be delivered. Now, I always use the one-third, one-third, one-third rule, of which my perennial listeners are familiar, and that would be this. When it comes to any weapon system, whether it's an exquisite platform like a U.S. carrier or an aircraft like a B-52, down to an artillery battery, one-third of your weapon systems, and this includes personnel too, are going to be ready to rock. One-third of them are going to be in training. They're going to be on leave. They're going to be doing other things. And one-third are going to be engaged in constitution and reconstitution and logistics activities, things like that, which means that, let's suppose, for instance, that you have, like the UK does, if we roll the British Army trigger pullers and the Royal Marines and the Royal Para Regiment and such, and we roll them all together, you come up with a really easy number of 10,000. Of that 10,000, in 24 hours, how many of those trigger pullers can be sent up on aircraft or on board ships to conduct the operations that they have to as violence and mayhem makers? You're looking at one-third. You're looking at 3,500. The same thing applies here. And also, one thing one has to realize when you look at all these inventories of weapons, it's just how arthritic, sclerotic, and ancient a lot of these weapon systems are. The Titan II was replaced by the Minuteman I in the 1960s. In the 1960s, the Minuteman went through three permutations, Minuteman I, II, and III, of which I am certain there are Minuteman I, II, and III, Alpha, Bravo, whatever the case may be, where you have versioning improvements year by year, maybe decade by decade, whatever the case may be. But the Minuteman IIIs that are currently deployed are very long in the tooth, and it was just this past year 2019, in which the 8-inch floppy disks that were used for reassignment and reconstitution of launch codes was replaced by another system to do it that was much more 21st century and in the digital age. Don't have the details for that. There's a reason why the government would not want you to have the details for it. One thing that worries me about that is that the courier system that employed the 8-inch floppy disks and the appropriate drives was a pretty bulletproof system to maintain secrecy. The moment one puts launch codes and things like that into the ether, no matter how secure the cloud may appear, what you have done is you have centralized the information in a fashion where if a backdoor is there that is expropriated or exploited or leveraged by a foreign intelligence service or a foreign military that may be hostile to U.S. national security, once they have that back door and once you've put it on the cloud or wherever they put it, It is vulnerable information that can be snatched. Now, I've mentioned before and I've talked about the disastrous Sentinel program that is in place right now to replace the aging Minuteman III inventories. The United States has embarked on a wide-ranging nuclear modernization program that will ultimately see every nuclear delivery system replaced with newer versions over the coming decades. In this case, we're talking through the 2060s, according to the prognostications they have. There was a current issue of Nuclear Notebook by the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And they estimated that the United States maintains that stockpile I mentioned earlier, an unchanged estimate from the previous year, in this case, 2023. And of those, I told you about how many are deployed. I also told you that 1,336 retired warheads are awaiting dismantlement. Just because one retires a warhead doesn't mean that it has been dismantled. There is only one armory. It's a plant in Texas that is in charge of safely dismantling and storing these nuclear munitions. And I am certain, like everything else, whether it's shipyards or manufacturing plants in the U.S., that they do not have sufficient throughput to get this thing done in a quick period of time because of this chaos avalanche of competency and the crisis that we have in manufacturing in the United States. I'm certain even that very exotic venue there of the dismantling of nuclear warheads and such is not up to snuff. By the way, I'd mentioned that inventory of 3,700-odd nuclear warheads. If these warheads I just mentioned that are awaiting dismantlement, they've been retired, but they're awaiting. So that brings the inventory of U.S. munitions to approximately 5,000 nuclear warheads. So I mentioned those ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. Obviously, those missiles are designed, quite literally, by namesake, to travel 6,000 to 9,300 miles by design. Now, there are 400 ICBMs in the current U.S. inventory. I had mentioned to you that these are arthritic and sclerotic and subject to updates that will astonish the layman. And what you discover, for instance, is that when it comes to what is the LGM-30 Golf Minuteman III, the successor to Minuteman I and II, the Mark 12 Alpha and the Mark 21/SERV, 200 each respectively, that the 12 Alpha was deployed in 79 and the 21 was deployed in 2006. Now we're going to do some math on air, so this is going to be easy though. Those 12 Alphas, the first variant that was deployed in 1979, those are actually MIRVs, which is multiple independent reentry vehicles. There's three of them on there. They're called Whiskey 78s with yields of approximately 335 kilotons. Now, the other 200, the other half of the ICBM complement that the U.S. has with the Minuteman IIIs, they do not have MIRVs. They have one warhead on there called a Whiskey 87. It is a yield of 300 kilotons, slightly less, but I suspect that, as I mentioned earlier, CEPs, circular error probability, the more accurate the missile warhead is, maybe the less kilotonnage yield is needed to make it effective. So the warhead total for what I just described is 800. Now we move to the SLBMs, the submarine launch ballistic missiles. These are classified under Trident and the DSLE-14 and 280s. Now, for the technically minded out there, there's all kinds of information available on the net that you can corroborate with other sources you may find to come to the single most accurate picture of what this looks like. Now, under those Trident IIs that I just described, you've got the Mark IV Alpha and you've got the Mark V. Now, one of those, the Mark IV Alpha, was deployed in 2008, the other one in 2019, and the Mark V was 1990. Now, for these, that Mark IV Alpha, the first one that I just described, these are all MIRVed, the Multiple Independent Reentry Vehicle, which means that for these, for instance, what you have is 8W76. That W designator in front of the numbers is the designator for nuclear weapons, munitions in the United States, and that's simply the way they do it. Those two Mark IV Alpha variants, one of them, the one issued in 2019, is still being deployed, but It has two W76s, and there's only 8 kilotons in the yield, while the previous one that had gone out in 2008 had 8 W76s with respective yields of 90 kilotons. And then we come to the Mark V, which was issued in 1990, where these were heavier hitters, because what you have is you have, they're MIRVed, and there are 8 Whiskey 88s on there with yields that exceed even that of the ICBMs I just described on the Minuteman III as 455 kilotons. And of these, the total for all three of these variants in the submarine force that we're aware of, remember, this is the unclassified read on this from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, is approximately 1,920. And then we move on to the bombers. So, just to keep you current here, if there's a Whiskey designator in front of it, most likely that thing is on top of a rocket. If there is a B designator, it means it's a bomb. So in this case with the bombers, the B-52H Stratofortress and the B-2 Alpha Spirit, and the B-2 is being dismissed from the Air Force as we speak to be replaced by the B-21. I've written about that on my blog at the Libertarian Institute, and what a clusterfuck and disaster that thing is. The last B-52 bomber to come off of the factory floor was in 1962. They are still aloft. They've doubled the shelf life so that we may have 100-year-old aircraft in the skies if the American Empire is still here in 2060. And what those bombers deploy is 500 Alikams. In this case, that's an air-launched cruise missile that has Whiskey 80s on board. Remember what I told you about those designators. If it's a Whiskey, it's on board of a missile of one type or another. Now, those Whiskey 80s on the Alikams, in this case, the air-launched cruise missiles that come off of those Stratofortresses, the B-2, they'll have 5 MIRVs, 5 independent warheads at 150 kilotons each. And then we move on to not the cruise missiles, but the bombs themselves. These could be glide bombs. These could be dumb bombs, smart bombs. The designator for both of the ones that are currently used, again, in the unclassified realm, is the Bravo 61 and the Bravo 83. These are deployed off of the now obsolescent, that's so funny to say that when you referring to the B-52 also, but the B-2 Spirit is obsolescent, according to the Air Force, and that's why they're replacing it with the B-21, which I forecast is going to be yet another disastrous Air Force program that will provide us with an aircraft that does not achieve any of its operational objectives. B-2 was deployed in 1994, and I think its shelf life is going to be approximately 30, 35 years, and then it's going to be done. They're the ones that deploy, not the cruise missiles I just mentioned that are going to be on the Stratofortress, the B-52, but these are actual bombs themselves, of which the total in the inventory is 288. So what that does is it brings that total to 788 when it comes to bombers. Total strategic forces, of which these three legs of the stool comprise, comes to 3,508, according to statistics from 2023 and early 2024. Now, there are some tactical Bravos that are employed by smaller aircraft like F-15s, F-16s, F-35s, which of course would give the Navy a surface aviation carrier-based aircraft modality, but these are rather small and their yields tend to be rather small. The yields are maybe up to 100 kilotons, whatever the case may be. And as a rough guesstimate when it comes to kiloton yields and such, a kiloton is, of course, 1,000 tons of TNT, and that magnitude of detonation is not large enough to destroy a city, but large enough to destroy a large building and much of a city block. So one can use those singleton kilotons and range them up to 100, 500, whatever the case may be, to come up with what that total happens to be for the destruction of a given target. Folks are always morbidly curious in this case of what was the largest bomb as far as kiloton yield that was ever designed by human beings since 1945. That would be the Tsar Bomba. It's the Western nickname for the Soviet RDS-220 hydrogen bomb, codenamed Vanya, detonated by the Soviet Union on October 30th, 1961. Tsar Bomba is the largest nuclear device ever detonated and the most powerful man-made explosion in history, with a yield of 50 megatons of TNT. Tsar Bomba was a culmination of a number of hydrogen bomb tests conducted throughout this time by both the USSR and the U.S. It's also referred to as the Kuzkina Mat, or Kuzma's mother. This was the nickname that may refer to Nikita Khrushchev's promise made in a 1960 session of the UN General Assembly to show the United States a Kuzkina Mat. For those of you who are curious, I'll give you a very brief overview. I talked about total strategic offensive forces available to the U.S. numbering at 3,500. Those for the Russians is at approximately 1,822. Of those, SLBMs are almost 1,000, and 1,200 are ICBMs. And then bombers and weapons that would be employed by said bombers are about 586, to include Bear aircraft, not because the Blackjacks, which is the Tupolev 160, Mike, they're few and far between, much like our B-2. They don't have many of them. I think they have 15 in the inventory. They've got the Bear aircraft. They've got 52 of those. That is their primary launch platform for their air launch cruise missiles. But these are propeller-driven aircraft that have an airspeed that is below 500 knots. So I've given you the technical preamble, and I want to make a suggestion, and that suggestion is this. The revolutions in military affairs in the 21st century concerning autonomous targeting, hypersonics, robotics, the ubiquity of UASs, for instance, and the coming ubiquity of unmanned ground combat vehicles, and even surface and submersible vehicles on the ocean, are obviating a lot of what has traditionally been these three legs of the strategic stool planet-wide for all the forces that employ these modalities. I would also tell you that in a nod to either the lethality of the United States or the curious thinking of the Russians, most of their ICBM inventory is mobile. Unlike ours, all of the U.S., ICBM and IRBM inventory is in fixed silos in the United States in positions that have been well established by anybody who wants to take them out for decades. In the show notes, I'll provide you with some technical resources that you can go to if you want to dive deeper into what I just covered. The entire reason that I am doing the Fixing Fight Club podcast series is to offer up an alternative to the tired, bloviated, expensive, and nonsensical DOD policies that have haunted the United States and led to consistent stalemate and defeat since the end of World War II. I'm trying to offer up some suggestions for either reconstitution or retirement of exquisite systems that need to stop being made. I'd like to quote Garrett Graff from Raven Rock, The Story of the U.S. Government's Secret Plan to Save Itself While the Rest of Us Die. I think that title is rather hyperbolic, but all of us must remember that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, their primary job isn't helping Americans when it comes to hurricanes, natural disasters, whatever the case may be. They have one primary mission, and that is COG, continuity of government, which is why Raven Rock, from Garrett Graff's title, is one of those facilities that is underground, along with others that pepper the continental United States, and most likely Alaska and Hawaii, to protect politicians and government officials. Graff, quote, "The result of the president launching the nation's bombers, submarines, and missiles against Russia would almost certainly destroy not only both countries, but all human life on the entire planet. There are some 30,000 nuclear weapons in the U.S. arsenal." His data is rather aged. The rough equivalent, one CIA director calculated, of 55 billion traditional 500-pound TNT bombs from World War II. Enough, he said, to carpet each state in the Union with a billion bombs and still have 5 million bombs left over. By the way, remember in here, Graf, and I guess he's dating himself, he says 30,000 weapons, and I have told you that clearly when it comes to the United States inventory, there are less than 5,000 right now. Nonetheless, his point obtains that suicide is what's going to be the answer to mutual assured destruction. So what I'd like to suggest is several things. The U.S. needs to significantly reduce the size of the bomber fleet and even the consideration of manned bombers as a viable 21st century weapon system. It needs to retire all land-based Minuteman III missile silos in the United States and convert all of those missile silos to climbing gyms and wine cellars, because they are eminently targetable, and they are targetable over multiple times, in which their survivability never goes above zero in any near-peer-or-peer conflagration. We need to increase the number of submarine-launched ballistic missile modalities. Now, as far as engineering, manufacturing throughput, shipyards, that is another consideration altogether, because there is a crisis in America, as I'd mentioned, not only with competency, but with quantitative throughput for the building of sophisticated hulls. I think there are only two nuclear shipyard-capable manufacturing and fabbing facilities available in the entirety of the United States. Now, if one were to adopt what I've spoken of before, which is the retirement and stoppage of manufacture of all aircraft carriers, that could go a long way from shifting focus on surface warfare ships, which are nothing more than missile sponges in 21st century naval warfare, and start to get the throughput that is needed to increase the number of submarines available on which you can have that single reliable leg of nuclear deterrent or nuclear options on board. Other savings that we could accrue from the things that I've just described could be reset and given to increase the mid-course interceptor technology that we currently have that I described earlier in this podcast concerning those 44. Remember those 44 that can only service a target at apogee in near space just before those MIRVs are unloaded, if it happens to be a multiple independent reentry vehicle that is on board. Because once they come down, we haven't the technology nor the means presently, because no one has paid enough attention to it or given it enough dollars to service terminally ballistic or terminally maneuvering hypersonic modalities. And again, we've all been peppered with this notion that hypersonics is new and it's a new way of warfare and such. At a lower level, it certainly is, because of how it's being used tactically and touching on operational. But as I mentioned earlier, ICBMs and IRBMs have been hypersonic since the 1950s. Conventional warheads, for instance, the world has been astonished. I don't know why, because somebody should have anticipated this, and I'm certain that a lot of defense observers in the West who didn't happen to speak Russian could say, yeah, this appears to be a parabolic rod from God, because what we have with the Oreshnik, it goes at 10 times the speed of sound. Hypersonics, of course, is 5 to 7 times the speed of sound. That would be Mach 10 in this case. It's like a meteorite. And it was immune to any missile defense system. And even Ukrainian military officials said it reached Mach 11 with a conventional warhead. Now remember, in the Soviet Union and then in Russia, they have always been an artillery-centric army. As a result of being artillery-centric, General Sergei Karakayev, he's the head of Russia's strategic missile forces, said the Oreshnik could carry nuclear or conventional warheads and has a range to reach any European target. It is most likely an IRBM, an intermediate range ballistic missile. Those usually have ranges between 300 to 3,400 miles in their classification. It's probably based on the Russian RS-26 Rubezh ICBM, but reduced. Now, the brilliance of this move is that if you take a conventional payload and you put it on something that is traveling in its terminal velocity of Mach 7 to 11, it will mimic the effects because of the energy dump at terminus when it lands on an earthly target, but won't have any radiation, of course, because it isn't a nuclear weapon, but will have devastating effects at terminus depending on the size of the payload. In addition, the DoD, that second D stands for defense after all, must go back and dust off what happened in the 1980s with Brilliant Pebbles, Smart Rocks, and the Strategic Defense Initiative programs, where the problem set before them was, we're going to defeat mutual assured destruction by ensuring that either in trajectory to the Apogee, missile is destroyed. At Apogee, when it's offloading its warheads, it is destroyed. Or in this case, when it is coming in at terminus at hypervelocity speeds, it is destroyed. One can look at these three distinct tracking modalities where it's going up in its parabola, where it reaches the top of its parabola. We're speaking ICBMs and IRBMs here. And then, of course, when it completes the parabola and starts coming back earthbound at its terminal velocity, which will most likely exceed Mach 10, which, by the way, since the 1950s, one can say arguably since the 1940s, has been a defeat mechanism for any kind of interception that one can possibly have against it because of those speeds. Because when it comes to targeting methodologies, what you have to do is you have to identify it, which means that you cue on it. Then you have to identify, what is it? Is it neutral? Is it friend? Is it foe? Is it unknown? And what missiles do I have? In this case, most likely it will be a missile. Do I have that can engage it? Back to Brilliant Pebbles, that was a ballistic missile defense program that was proposed by no less a nuclear seer than the infamous Edward Teller of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in 1987, near the end of the Cold War, because, of course, the wall would fall in the next half decade. The system would consist of thousands of small satellites, each with missiles similar to conventional heat-seeking missiles, non-nuclear warheads, placed in low Earth orbit, LOE, so that hundreds would be above the Soviet Union at the time. If the Soviets launched their ICBM fleet, the Pebbles would detect their rocket motors using infrared seekers. And in this case, we can use different seeking technology in the 21st century and collide with them. Because the Pebble strikes the ICBM before the latter could release its warheads, each Pebble could destroy several warheads with one shot. Might I say that from a physics perspective, when something is traveling in low Earth orbit, it is traveling at a high velocity. And what happens, even if it is a frozen pea, if it happens to be traveling at a velocity in excess of Mach 10, and that frozen pea impacts with the very thin skin of an ICBM or an IRBM that is entering low Earth orbit or near space or whatever the case may be, it is going to destroy it. Brilliant Pebbles is apparently it was Daniel O'Graham's Strategic Defense Initiative notion called Smart Rock. So it was a concept that was playing on that. And Smart Rocks envisioned large orbital battle stations equipped with powerful sensors and carrying numerous small missiles. I have to say again, these don't have to be missiles in the conventional sense. They can simply be quite literally frozen peas, frozen vegetables, rocks, tungsten rods, whatever the case may be. If they impact on something that is traveling at a high speed and enough of them impact, then it can neutralize it. Now, as far as nuclear munitions explosions in low Earth orbit or coming back on parabola and at speeds, that's something that has to be examined. But to intercept missiles promptly, those autonomous pebbles, remember I mentioned autonomous targeting and the importance in this 21st century salvo competition of hypersonic munitions, there will not be time for a human being in their cognition loop or the number of human beings in a targeting loop to say, yea and verily, we must fire on that. It must be automatic. By the way, when you look at some of the technical literature, for instance, I found a PDF called Space-Based Missile Interceptor Sizing Methodology, because you have to ask yourself, well, how big do these things have to be if they're up there to intercept these IRBMs and the ICBMs at the top of their parabola. Some suggest that the empty weight is around 20 kilograms. That's a little over 42 pounds. And the all-up weight, including the life jacket, would be about 1,850. So based on this, the total cost at the time when they published this study of 2,600 of these pebbles would be $76 billion. That's an estimate from 2004. So I'm certain that you could probably add two-thirds to that price as far as current inflation that America has been suffering since the dawn of the 21st century. But nonetheless, ask yourself this, for instance, and remember, all these figures, I think, for the most part, are vaporware. Would it be worth spending $150 billion of the current Pentagon's budget on defensive mechanisms against IRBMs and ICBMs, and possibly, and I say this possibly, not probably, making this whole nuclear mad doctrine moot? I don't know. I'm making these suggestions. I'm throwing this out there. Here's what I'm suggesting at the baseline, at the very least. It is time for the Department of Defense to be held accountable to defend the homeland, not homeland security or anything like that, to defend the actual homeland. And part of my Fixing Fight Club focus has been a complete stand down of the American military establishment, and by extension, the Western military establishment, whether that's NATO or the Pacific Rim, to concentrate on protecting the populations that pay the money in the first place to project power abroad, to engage in conflicts, to get in these wars, whether you love them or leave them, whatever the case may be. That has been neglected for the entirety of the 20th century, and here we are in the 21st century, and they're continuing that immoral path of refusing to defend the homeland against what is arguably the largest threats in 21st century warfare, which is missiles, which is salvo competition, which is a war of leakers where defensive umbrellas, no matter how stout and redoubtable they may be, are penetrated by a number of missiles that end up landing in places, both military and civilian targets, that suffer severe casualties. Now, I tend to speak to kinetic modalities that happen to be anti-missiles or missiles or such. And of course, science fiction and Hollywood would tell us that directed energy weapons, whether they are microwave or laser or whatever the case may be, would be the way to do this. I would tell you from a physics and science and engineering perspective, lasers are way off as far as that because of thermal blooming and a variety of other physics hurdles that have to be overcome to ensure that they can be safely employed and effectively employed. And when I mention safely employed, what I mean by this is that when it comes to directed energy munitions and weapon systems, these are fratricidal by their very nature. For instance, if I'm employing microwaves or lasers, whatever is in the path of that, even if it happens to be friendly, will be something that will suffer just as badly as the target will that it was originally arrayed against. We also have to consider the practical perspective of this. Number one, whether the West admits this or not, it will be in a fiscally austere environment in the coming years, whether it likes it or not. If it's fiscally austere and all of a sudden budgets have to be reduced, what that will mean is that as a result of those budget reductions, then you will be able to employ less exquisite platforms. If that's the case, start investing in the platforms that work. As I have said again and again, the aircraft carrier is the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century. As we're discovering in the Ukrainian-Russian conflict, when it comes to manned tanks, that's a lot of money that can be destroyed for less than $100,000, and we're finding that consistently throughout. So the plea from this particular episode is that defense from nuclear weapons has to be taken seriously, despite the fact that, as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, the worldwide nuclear weapons proliferation that peaked in 1986 and 1988 at 30,000 munitions total, which is now less than 10,000 munitions total, nonetheless, that trajectory is continuing, but it's continuing in an environment in which defensive means against nuclear munitions, much less hypersonic conventional munitions, doesn't play any significant role in the planning of the West, and I think that that is military malpractice. I wanted to offer a quote from Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Yes, the same Daniel Ellsberg who was responsible for the Pentagon Papers and other such releases. While he tends to offer some pie-in-the-sky and very unicorn-like notions in his prognostication of what's wrong, to include nuclear winter and other such things, I'm going to not entertain that because while it's possible, maybe probable, it is not a convincing enough thing to take all of the nuclear powers from the brink on spelling each other and casting a spell on each other to think that if you shoot, we'll shoot. But he has a very interesting reading here, and that is this, quote, "The easiest and fastest way to reduce that risk, and indeed the overall danger of nuclear war, is to dismantle entirely, not merely de-alert, the Minuteman III missile force, currently scheduled for refurbishment, the U.S. land-based leg of the nuclear triad. Former Secretary of Defense William Perry has argued precisely that, as has James E. Cartwright, former commander of the Strategic Air Command and vice chairman of the JCS. A second stage would be to reduce the Trident submarine-based ballistic missiles force to give up its capability to target and destroy the entire Russian land-based missile force, one on which the Russians choose to rely far more than does the United States, having first deprived the Russians of their high-priority time-urgent targets for those forces by dismantling the U.S. Minuteman silos and the control centers. The remaining incentive for the Russians is to launch their ICBMs on warning to avert their being destroyed by U.S. submarine-launched ballistic missiles would be eliminated. Launch on warning would no longer be susceptible of being rationalized strategically on other side." He goes on, "All of those propositions apply with equal force to the current vulnerable opposing offensive nuclear forces of India and Pakistan." Then he goes on to say something very interesting that I concur with, and that's, quote, "That strategy remains in force, although, as noted, the objective of limiting damage to the U.S. in large-scale nuclear war, or of keeping such a war with a nuclear state limited, has been essentially a hoax, infeasible to achieve for about 50 of those years, ever since the Soviets acquired submarine-launched ballistic missiles and a large force of hardened ICBMs. Even striking first, it has not been feasible to avoid the effect of total destruction of U.S. society. Even earlier, that was not feasible for Western Europe by blast, heat, radiation, and fallout alone from the Russian retaliation." And finally, quote, "The sole purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons should be to deter nuclear attack on the United States and its allies. That sole purpose can and should be accomplished with radically lowered numbers of U.S. nuclear weapons, almost entirely SLBMs, ICBMs having been dismantled as they should have been generations ago. This shift would not totally eliminate the dangers of nuclear war, but it would abolish the threat of nuclear winter." End of quote. While he freights that with much more importance than I do, for me, the other thing is the gambit, which is the prisoner's dilemma, which is the fact that with all of these hardened, in-place, siloed missiles on either hand, whether Russian or United States or any other, in game strategy, one discovers that if you have fixed, deliberate target sets that happen to be the highest priority, the threat to your land, those will be targeted, probably targeted in salvos. If you eliminate that and you start playing a Where's Waldo game with the SLBMs and such, then it becomes much more problematic with first strikes. We need a civil public discussion, not simply with defense intellectuals, but with everybody across the country, across the aisle, to discuss, is it time to dismantle, or is it time to disabuse ourselves of the notion that having all these hair-trigger nuclear weapons that are world-threatening is the wise course of action, especially in these times in the 21st century of these incredible revolutions in military affairs and autonomous targeting and robotics and hypervelocity munitions and hypervelocity flight, defensive and offensive with that. We live in the 21st century era of manned warfare in which things have changed so consequentially, it is earth-shattering from a millennial standpoint. So with that, I hope you enjoyed listening. I hope to hear your comments. And if you enjoyed this, be sure to leave a review on the podcast vendor of your choice that you happen to be listening to me on. And I thank you for your solicitude. If you wish to get in touch with me, that is cgpodcast@pm.me, cgpodcast@pm.me. Or you can check out my Substack, the address for which will be in the show notes. Thanks for listening.